How about a little
good music?
Yeah, some good music. Absolutely. Yeah. We are going to be joined this week by Michael Ray Fitzgerald. He is the author of numerous books, including Jacksonville and the Roots of Southern Rock. On previous episodes, Craig, we've talked about your love for music. Where does Southern Rock fall into your hierarchy of favorites?
Well, you have to bear in mind that although I have spent almost my entire life in Florida, I went to college in Alabama, and I was there around the time that the big Lynyrd Skynyrd anthem, you know, Sweet Home Alabama, came out. So I got real sick of that one.
Yeah,
but I really like some of their other stuff, and also Allman Brothers. You know, everybody in college was grooving on the Allman Brothers Live at Fillmore East. So, I mean, that's sort of part of the fabric of life growing up here, yeah, is hearing that stuff.
Yeah.
And the idea that so many of these bands came out of Jacksonville, I'm intrigued to find out how that happened.
Yep. The book, again, Jacksonville and the Roots of Southern Rock. It was published earlier this fall. You can find it on Amazon.com and all over online. The Allman Brothers Band and Lynyrd Skynyrd helped usher in a new kind of Southern music from Jacksonville, Florida. Together, they and fellow bands like Blackfoot, 38 Special, and Molly Hatchet would reset the course of 70s rock, yet Jacksonville seemed an unlikely hotbed for a new musical movement. And with that, we welcome in the author of Jacksonville and the Roots of Southern Rock, Michael Ray
Fitzgerald.
Michael,
this is a fascinating book about something I've long wondered about. How did you kind of get into dealing with the mystery of how Jacksonville spawned so much great music?
Well, because I lived here and watched it happen.
When did this start taking place?
It started exactly when I moved here in April of 1968. That's the same month the Second Coming got here from Tampa, which included Dickie Betts and Barry Oakley.
Now, you may want to tell people a little bit more about who those folks are. I know who they are, but because I'm a longtime fan. But you may want to explain how the Second Coming related to what they became.
Dickie Betts had been coming to Jacksonville for many years to get gigs because there were a lot of gigs available up here, and he told all his friends this was the place to go in Florida, you know, if you wanted to cop a gig. He and Barry Oakley had a band called the Blues Messengers. Oakley had come down from Chicago, and they were playing in a bar in Tampa, and a club owner from Jacksonville named Leonard Ransler saw them, and he offered him a gig at his new club in Jacksonville called The Scene on the condition that they change their name to The Second Coming because he thought Barry Oakley looked like Jesus with his long hair and his beard. They came to Jacksonville. They were the only rock band, you know, underground hippie rock band in Jacksonville, counterculture band. And they had to put up with a lot of harassment from a lot of rednecks, but they soon cornered the market on all the hippie music fans in Jacksonville, and they became the biggest band in Jacksonville. And one of their fans who came to see them a lot and hung out with them was Duane Allman from Daytona Beach.
Hmm. Now, people think of Southern Rock, they think of Macon, Georgia, I think, because of Capricorn Records being there. But the Allmans were definitely a Florida-born and bred band, right?
Absolutely. The brothers Allman, Duane and Greg, were from Daytona Beach, and they started, I think, 65 or 66. One of their first gigs was opening for the Beach Boys in Daytona Beach.
Wow.
Is that when they were the Allman Joys?
I think it was earlier than that. I think they were called the Escorts.
So,
but they were kind of legendary. They started coming to Jacksonville and sitting in with the Second Coming at the club called The Scene. And then when Barry talked the band into doing these free concerts in the park, which they called B-Ins, he started coming to those too. And they didn't realize that he already had a record deal and he was kind of secretly auditioning players for his new band. Uh-huh. And of course, the record label was based in Macon. So, you know, Macon was the headquarters for Southern Rock at that time, but Jacksonville was like the mother lode.
Yeah, the spawning ground. Now, you made an interesting point in the book where you said it's not right to call Jacksonville the birthplace of Southern Rock.
No.
But it's where the roots are. Could you explain that a little
bit? Well, it's not the birthplace of Southern Rock because other people were doing Southern Rock before the Allman Brothers Band existed. In fact, one of the bands that was doing Southern Rock was Duane and Greg Allman's group, The Hourglass. And they were based in Los Angeles at this time. And they even recorded It's Not My Cross to Bear. So people were working on a Southern Rock sound before 1969. The Hourglass being one such group. Delaney Bramlett and Leon Russell together were forging a Southern rock sound out in Los Angeles. So there were other Southern rock bands before the Allman Brothers. So Jacksonville could not have been the so-called birthplace. But it, like I said, it was the mother load. It was where most of the Southern rock groups came from.
And what made the conditions in Jacksonville ripe, like you said, for picking up so many gigs for the artists to be able to play and practice and meet each other and hone their craft and allow for that kind of petri dish effect to take over where these guys all got together and it kind of spawned out of here?
There was a huge demand for live music in Jacksonville, which, you know, Betts had noticed before, you know, years previously. He started coming to Jacksonville in 65, playing at the Normandy Club and places like that. There was a huge demand for live music. People here, you know, whereas some places people would go to record hops to go to dance, you know, to dance. You know, teens would go to record hops. You had to have live bands here in Jacksonville. And I think that had a lot to do with the radio station called WAPE, which was a 50,000-watt blowtorch, and you could hear it from Daytona all the way to North Carolina. And WAPE would play local acts. You know, they would play records, even played a record by Lynyrd Skynyrd. And if you got played on a 50,000-watt station here in Jacksonville, you could get a lot of gigs. So there was a huge demand for live music in Jacksonville. And I think Big Ape kind of stoked that.
Sure. I work in the radio business. WAPE has moved over to FM. And as recently, even into the 80s, WAPE was an incredibly powerful national music station. When you talk about trying to break bands out and the important radio stations across the country, obviously it migrated from AM to FM as that technology evolved and popularized. But WAPE was a big deal radio station, not only nationally, of course, in the South, but for a long, long time.
Yeah, it was. It could make or break an artist easily. It was probably the most powerful station south of Nashville. The Big Ape, you know, supported local acts. You couldn't get away with this in New York or Los Angeles because of the payola scandals. There was a big payola scandal in the early 60s, and so radio station owners stopped playing local acts because it was too easy to skim for money, to skim the bands for money. But Bill Brennan, who owned Big Ape, didn't care about any of this. He let the DJs do whatever they wanted, and one of the DJs on a Sunday night show, had his own Sunday night show, was Alan Facemeyer, and he managed the Second Coming, so he played their records.
That's a nice setup.
Yeah, and everybody looked the other way. And then he also, I think, founded a series of concerts on the Big Ape grounds, also called BNs, and the Big Ape would have bands playing in the field around the tower. The Big Ape was really the sponsor of Jacksonville's music scene, and it doesn't get enough credit, but if you dig, you'll find it. Besides airplay, it supported the music scene in other ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, because you talk about, I mean, like you say, the music scene is like an ecosystem. You need the radio, and again, we're going back 40 years. It's not at all like this anymore, but you needed a record shop. You know, you needed a place to buy albums and just beyond Michael Jackson and Lionel Richie and the Bee Gees. And you needed the club venues, and all of this fed on each other, and it sounded like that was a fertile ground, and there were all those components in place in Jacksonville.
And TV jumped on the bandwagon. There were local music programs like American Bandstand here featuring local bands.
Wow.
And the newspapers jumped on the bandwagon, so we had full support from the media on all fronts.
That explains why bands would come to Jacksonville to play, but how did they wind up sort of developing that similar blues-based hell for leather sound that we know as Southern rock?
Ah. They were all fans of Cream. Every single one of them was Eric Clapton acolyte, every one of them. That sunburst guitar that Duane Allman played, Clapton had made it famous when he was with the Blues Breakers. The Marshall Stacks, that was Clapton. Dickie Betts would play Crossroads by Cream, note for note. Don Barnes said every one of us wanted to be Clapton.
Well, and of course, Duane played with Clapton.
There you go. Clapton is the unacknowledged godfather of the Jacksonville
sound.
I was starting to say, and Clapton ended up becoming a Duane Allman fan and inviting him to play on Layla, right?
Isn't that something? They recognized that they were both going after the same thing.
Good point. There's a great anecdote in the section on the Allman Brothers where Duane is watching, I think it was Johnny Winter play at some big concert.
Yeah.
And he says to somebody, he's good, but I could cut him. I love that. And I'm going to be down on that stage next time.
You know, if anybody could cut Duane Allman, it would have been Dickie Betts. Duane Allman said that Dickie Betts was the better player. Dickie Betts was the guitar god of Florida in 1969.
When did this break out from Jacksonville, Macon, and become a wider regional, national movement?
In 1971, when the brothers did Live at the Fillmore East, Allman Brothers at Fillmore East in 1971, that was their big breakout. And Statesboro Blues, I believe, was on that album.
Yeah,
and first two albums hadn't really done much. Their first two albums sold 35,000 copies.
It set a new standard for live albums, too, didn't it?
Yeah, I think it pretty much put the live album on the map. Well, Cream had been doing that, too, I should say.
What about that album captivated people to such an extent?
The guitar playing. The whole thing was about guitars. Electric guitars, the whole thing. Despite the fact that you had one of the great R&B, soul/rock vocalists, Greg Allman, and on a Hammond organ, it was all about the guitars.
Are any of those live music venues they played at still around in the Jacksonville area?
No. Actually, I was contacted by a librarian, a fellow named Ryan Reed, at Willow Branch Library, who's trying to put together a tribute concert to the original BNs, or the early BNs that were held on Willow Branch Park. Reese Winans was there, and Barry Oakley was there, and I don't think Duane or Greg was there, but it was sort of the birth of the Jacksonville scene were these free BNs. Yeah, Duane Allman was at a lot of them, though, not this particular one. He wrote a letter to his girlfriend, and it's published in Galadriel Allman's book about what an amazing thing was going on here in Jacksonville with all these hippies, mm-hmm. you know, all these freaks, he called them, gathering in these mm-hmm. parks and to hear this free music. And he just said he just couldn't believe it. It was like San Francisco or something.
I'm just guessing here, but would you say that probably the three most famous Southern rock songs are probably, what, Freebird?
Yeah.
Sweet Home Alabama and Ramblin' Man, you think? If somebody wanted to sample.
Yeah. Those were all pretty big hits. Well, Freebird wasn't a big hit on the pop charts, but certainly I think Sweet Home Alabama went to number two, and I think Ramblin' Man went to number two.
So how did Freebird, which is what, like 9 minutes long, how did that wind up becoming such an anthem?
You know, it started off not that long. A friend of mine, Tom Markham, who owned worked at a recording studio back then, his partner Jim Sutton found Lynyrd Skynyrd at a teen club called the Comic Book Club downtown, and they signed him, and they did the original recording of Freebird, and it's available on Lynyrd Skynyrd's box set, and it was only about 5 or 6 minutes long. It wasn't released as a single. In fact, it wasn't released at all. First time the band played, it was on a TV show. And then it just kept growing and growing and growing. They did a version of it in Muscle Shoals with Jimmy Johnson producing, and it had gone up to like 7 minutes or 9 minutes. And then by the time they signed with Al Kooper and recorded a third version, it had gotten up to like 10, 11 minutes. So there's three different versions of Freebird floating around there. But obviously you couldn't play it on AM radio or pop radio mm-hmm. because it was too long. But it got played on FM, the underground stations at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's the guitar part at the end that I think really makes it memorable. And, of course, that gets cut off when they were playing for a single, I think.
You know, if you know anything about guitar playing, you'll recognize that everything that Alan Collins does is all recycled Clapton licks, every mm-hmm. single thing.
How did Lynyrd Skynyrd come together as a band?
Well, they were all went to school here right in my neighborhood where I live now, Lakeshore Middle School. Most of them went here, Alan and Gary and Ronnie and Larry Junstrom, they all went to high, and Bob Burns, they all went to junior, middle school together. So they all knew each other. They were neighborhood buddies. And it really started with Gary and Bob Burns jamming in Bob Burns' parents' carport over on Park Street in the Lakeshore neighborhood. Gary and Bob Burns were the ones who put the original nucleus of the group together. They didn't have a regular bass player. Larry Johnstrom came in later. And then Ronnie had been in with a couple of different bands. I don't know why he left the group he was in. I can't remember, but he just went over to their house one day and said, "Hey, I want to be your new singer." And they said, "Oh, sure." You didn't say no to Ronnie Van Zandt.
When would you say was the apex of Southern rock?
It was about mid-70s, because it started going out of style after that. The apex was probably Charlie Daniels' song, "The South Is Going to Do It Again." And then when Phil Walden helped finance Jimmy Carter's election campaign, and by the way, there's a movie out about this now called Jimmy Carter Rock and Roll President. And so all these Southern rock guys did benefits, including Lynyrd Skynyrd, did benefits to help finance Jimmy Carter's campaign and help put him in the White House. So that was the apex of 76 when Carter got elected. And they helped. All these guys helped.
And then sort of went into decline after that, right?
Well, then you had disco and punk coming in. And then, you know, I mean, Southern rock had passed its sell-by date, and it was starting to get kind of stale. And you had a younger generation coming up, you know, with punk and new wave. You know, the Knack came along with My Sharona and just basically bumped the Southern rockers to the background. And then it was hard going after that.
Well, in the Lynyrd Skynyrd plane crash, as I look online, October 20th, 1977. So that was less than a year later. Obviously, that doesn't help when one of the premier acts is suffers a tragedy of that scale.
Yeah, but you know, it's also possible that had it not, the band not been so rudely interrupted, that they might have gone the way the Allman Brothers went at the time, which was just kind of receded into the background because of Southern rock going out of style.
It's interesting, though, how influential these guys were. I mean, there's a whole Drive-By Truckers album, including Lynyrd Skynyrd, Southern Rock Opera, is what it's called.
I know it.
And
I know it.
And I love the song about you know, I'm afraid to die. Well, so is everybody. Shut up and get on the plane. It's just a great song. Would you count the Tedeschi Trucks Band as sort of carrying on the legacy of Southern rock?
How could you divorce Derek Trucks and the slide guitar from Southern rock? Even if they don't want to be called Southern rock, they're going to get saddled with that label because of his slide plan, you know, and his association. Well, he was in the Allman Brothers for 15 years.
And he's the son of the drummer, Butch Trucks, right?
No, he's his nephew. So he's indelibly linked to Southern rock, so he could not escape that rubric even if he wants to. And he does want to. I mean, if you study his career, he did everything he could to avoid being a Southern rock act, and he just finally had to accept it.
It's interesting, though. Their band, he and his wife's band, play a wide variety of music. I mean, they'll do like a whole Sly Stone medley and things like that. But yeah, sometimes I guess they have to work in some Allman Brothers too.
I spent a whole chapter debating what is Southern rock anyway. I mean, what does Wet Willie have in common with Marshall Tucker? You know, absolutely nothing. So, I mean, there's a whole spectrum of Southern rock, you know, from like the soul side, which obviously Tedeschi Trucks Band would fall into, and also the Wet Willie would fall into, then to the countryside, which would be more like, you know, Dickie Betts,
Marshall Tucker,
and
yeah.
Marshall Tucker, right. So, and everything in between. So what is Southern rock? It's a meaningless term when you really put it under the microscope.
Would you count Tom Petty in there?
Some people would, but he flirted with a Southern rock image. He had a rebel flag he flew on stage back in 85. He did the album Rebels with songs about the South on it and the Civil War. And he looked like he was going to jump on board the Southern rock bandwagon, but then he thought better of it, and then he decided it was a downright stupid thing to do, he said, in his own words. He especially regretted flying the rebel flag. He finally said, "We're not a Southern rock band, we're an L.A. band." So he made a point to divorce himself from his Southern roots publicly. He didn't want to be part of the Southern rock crowd.
Genre.
Yeah, because there are some racist undertones connected with the rebel flag. So he thought it was a really bad idea.
Yeah, well, that's where I was going to go. The whole Southern rock, the term Southern, to say nothing of the Confederate flag, which has obviously totally jumped the shark in the popular culture, being completely co-opted by white nationalists. How do you think some of the imagery, some of the song lyrics, how do you think they play and wear and are heard by a contemporary audience that is processing Black Lives Matter and George Floyd and the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville and the contemporary race conversation we're having?
I'm not sure Lynyrd Skynyrd's ever going to be able to live down its association with that flag. That flag is kryptonite.
Yeah. Did they actually stop flying it finally?
They did, and a lot of their audience members complained about it and threatened to boycott them if they didn't reinstate it. Unfortunately, people associate the music with the flag, so in a lot of people's minds, Southern rock is redneck flag wave, rebel flag waving music, and you know it's not. Some of it, maybe a little bit of it is, but most of it is not. I mean, most of it's actually homage to black music, especially when you get in with groups like Wet Willie. It's pretty much a white R&B band. And the Allman Brothers, previous band, the Hourglass, was a white R&B band. So it's really a shame that people lump all this Southern rock genre with racism and the rebel flag, because it's not accurate.
Particularly Lynyrd Skynyrd embraced it. You're talking in the book about Al Kooper designing their image as these sort of rowdy Southern boys. They embraced it as part of a marketing technique, and now it's kind of come back to bite them.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. That is exactly right. They didn't even know they were a Southern rock band until Al Kooper told them. You know, Al Kooper was looking for a Southern rock band, and he found Skynyrd, and he said, you know, these guys can be what I'm looking for. I mean, they're not. They didn't even know they were a Southern rock band. And so
it took a guy from Brooklyn to tell him.
Exactly. He talked him into being this image that he had already had in his head. So, I mean, you could arguably say Al Kooper is one of the primary architects of Southern rock, because the term didn't even exist until 1972.
Wow.
So Kooper talked him into being this Southern rock bad boy rowdy band. Mm-hmm. I mean, they already had this in them, but he elicited it and, you know, codified it and commodified it and made a gimmick out of it. And then they knew, Ronnie Van Zant knew they were flirting with controversy when he wrote Sweet Home Alabama, because he told the band members, well, this one's either going to piss everybody off so bad we'll never get another chance, or it's going to be a big hit, one or the other. People are still debating whether it's pro-racist or anti-racist.
Wow.
I don't think Ronnie was a racist, but he had, you know, a lot of bigots.
He admired George Wallace, who wasn't the most enlightened guy in the world. That's for sure.
That's right. The whole band accepted plaques from George Wallace at a ceremony in Alabama where he made them honorary colonels in the Alabama militia.
Nice.
So they knew what they were doing. Al Kooper tells a great, you know, I don't think Ronnie was a bigot, but they knew they were flirting with, hot button symbology, you know? Al Kooper tells a story about he and Gary Rossington, and you're the first person to know who that was, because I heard it from Ed King. Ronnie and Gary Rossington were over at Al Kooper's house, and Al Kooper busted out a Stratocaster that Jimi Hendrix had given him. So he handed it to Gary, and Ronnie says, guess who that guitar used to belong to? Tell him who that guitar used to belong to. And Al Kooper says, it used to belong to Jimi Hendrix. And then Gary let it drop on the floor, and he goes, ooh, I got some N-word on me.
Oh, Lord. Oh, ooh. Yuck.
This is documented in Kooper's book, and I happen to know it was Rossington. Ronnie, to his eternal credit, said, well, you better pick it up and get some more on you.
Speaking of flirting, let's talk about Molly Hatchet briefly.
Yeah.
I have long contended that instead of our current state anthem being Old Folks at Home, a.k.a. Way Down on the Suwannee River, which has its own racial problems,
we should switch to Flirting with Disaster by Molly Hatchet, which I think is a more accurate depiction of life in Florida. It's a little bit about that group.
Flirting with Disaster could have been the theme song for the whole Southern rock movement, because they were all, you know, hard drinkers, hard partiers, you know, drug users and risk takers, and they all, and it was almost like a game or a contest, you know, like everybody was playing chicken to see who could destroy himself the first. So Flirting with Disaster makes a great theme song for Southern rockers in general. The only group that didn't really indulge in this kind of destructive, not the only group, but the premier group that didn't indulge in this kind of self-destructive behavior was 38 Special. But a lot of the others made a big deal about, you know, basically killing themselves.
Yeah.
And it's pretty widely agreed, and I would say that Molly Hatchet would not have made it as big as they did if it had not been for Skynyrd's early demise, unfortunate demise. They had already been working with Ronnie Van Zant. Pat Armstrong, who was one of Skynyrd's first managers, he co-managed them with Alan Walden out of Macon. Pat Armstrong was turned on to Molly Hatchet by somebody in 38 Special, so Armstrong brought them to Ronnie Van Zant. And then Ronnie Van Zant agreed to produce the band, and he brought them into his studio. The Lynyrd Skynyrd had a studio on Riverside Avenue in Jacksonville. And he helped them arrange their songs, and he was going to produce them, and he was going to shop them around to record labels. He took Molly Hatchet under his wing. And then the crash happened, and that wasn't going to happen. But they were in a unique position to kind of pick up where Lynyrd Skynyrd left off.
We keep talking about Lynyrd Skynyrd, but we have to mention the gym teacher that gave them their name.
Sure.
What happened to him? Lynyrd Skynyrd. How did he wind up with their name?
He had Alzheimer's and died a few years ago, but he was the PE coach at Robert E. Lee High School. And he used to harass Bob and Gary about their hair. So they would get stoned and get paranoid, and Bob would make a joke. Bob Burns, the drummer, say to Gary, go, Lynyrd Skynyrd's coming to get you. And the phone would ring, and it's Lynyrd Skynyrd, he's coming to get you. And so one night, I was in the Forest Inn when 1%, that was the band's name, I was there, and Ronnie Van Zant goes, hey, y'all, he's talking to the guy, he's taking like a little focus group, he goes, hey, y'all, we're thinking about changing the name of the band, what do y'all think? We're thinking about changing it to Lynyrd Skynyrd. And the crowd was full of Robert E. Lee High School students, and they all were hooting and hollering, and I didn't know who Lynyrd Skynyrd was. So I looked over to this hippie standing next to me, and I said, who's Lynyrd Skynyrd? And he goes, oh, that's the PE coach at Lehigh who hassles them about their hair.
Wow. Well, and it brings up something we should have mentioned. You had a front row seat to all of this. Knew the guys, went to the shows. I mean, you were intimately involved in this, and those are the stories and insights that are told and shared in Jacksonville and the Roots of Southern Rock. Our guest has been Michael Ray Fitzgerald. This has been wonderful, a great look back at a definite period in time that has certainly lived long, long since it kind of faded out.
Hey, I really appreciate it, man. You guys were so cool. You know your stuff.